Making a recipe that calls for butter? Make it better with European butter from France. With a minimum of 82% butterfat, it's no wonder French butter is the number one choice for chefs the world over. Whether you're whipping up an omelet, sauteing vegetables, or spreading it on toast, the rich, cultured flavor of butter from France always elevates. Be sure to look for Made in France on the label, and for recipes, tips, and tricks, go to tasteeurope.com.
It feels so good not to travel right now. You know, I'll get back there at some point, but my body is just so happy to be, you know, not only in one place and on the precipice of having my own home again, but also to be in a city that completely satisfies whatever juice is left in the well of my wanderlust.
You're listening to the Taste Podcast. I'm Editor-in-Chief Matt Rodbard, here with Senior Editor Anna Hiesel.
On today's show, Matt talks to Bill Addison, a new restaurant critic at the Los Angeles Times. Also on today's show, Matt talks with Kim and Tyler Malik, the co-founders of ice cream company Salt and Straw. But Matt, what did you and Bill talk about?
Anna, it's exciting times at the Los Angeles Times food desk. And Bill Addison recently joined as one of the two critics covering what many, this writer included, consider to be the richest food city in America, richest being they have great food there. Bill and I talk about his marching orders and how he will navigate the urban sprawl of L.A.
What are his marching orders? What is he working on right now? Anything specific?
He would not reveal what he's working on as a true critic and journalist. He would not reveal his sources.
Fair enough.
But Bill does talk about a cuisine that he's focusing on a little bit more specifically than others, which is the food of the Middle East. He's seeking out homey Syrian and Persian cooking to, of course, go along with the Mexican, Korean, Chinese, Vietnamese, Japanese, Salvadorian, and Californian restaurants the city is famous for.
Here's Matt talking to Bill Addison.
Bill Addison, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Oh, great to see you in LA, your new home.
Home. I love that word now.
So you were on Eater's Roving Critic. Everyone who's read about you knows that you spent almost 5 years on the road. A lot of people said, oh, yeah, of course, Bill, that's a dream job. But I think I've been living in a hotel for 5 days in New York, in L.A., and it's tough. How did you survive 5 years on the road?
Determination. I don't know. Well, I gave up my home in Atlanta. I sold it in May 2017, and I just gave up the idea of having a permanent place to live. I'm moving into an apartment in Los Angeles this week, and so it'll be the first time in 22 months that I've had a place to call my own, and I'm really excited about that.
What are you setting up first? What is the first? I know there's like a bar or a television.
It's funny because it has a little bar to it, which is cool kind of in the renovation. I really like mid-century modern. My home in Atlanta was mid-century modern. This apartment is mid-century modern.
Oh,
there's
nice.
A lot of that in Los Angeles. So I'm just excited. My furniture's going to arrive this week. There's a chair that I love, and I just want to sit in that chair. I've forgotten really what it feels like to just, sit by a window in that chair. So I'm probably just going to curl up and start staring at my laptop in that chair.
And this is where your writing is going to happen. You've already, that must feel really good to have a home to write. Writing is so personal.
Almost. It's there. I can't, until it happens,
okay.
I won't believe it.
We won't jinx it. So you are now one of two restaurant critics at the LA Times. I want to just know, what is your overall job description? I know you will be filing these reviews. You've already filed many, and we'll get to that. But what else are you going to be doing? There's got to be a lot of things to this role.
I should say, though, that the reviews are the fundament of what we're doing. And I love that. I mean, we're obviously at this moment where, California is not only being watched very closely, it was announced today that the Michelin Guide is coming back and not just re-entering the Los Angeles market after a decade, but covering all of California, a guide to the state. The Chronicle has a new critic, and Soleil Ho, who just published her first reviews very recently. Tejal Rao is here doing her amazingness for the New York Times. And they hired Patricia and I, and Patricia and me. Sorry.
Yeah.
And then
what? We're speaking. We're not writing.
Right,
we would
exactly.
have made that error on the page, what, Bill. Okay. You know that. Don't need to correct your speech.
Thank you. I think what's interesting at first glance is at this sort of unprecedented moment where you have four new people, brand new people, writing about restaurants in California, kind of everyone's different take. Patricia and I are really just digging down and doing that yeoman's work of restaurant criticism. We're both a little, you know, maybe old-fashioned and dedicated to service journalism in that way, which is not to say that the culture criticism that Solejo is going to be bringing is like so, you know, important to this moment in the conversation, and the way that Tejal digs into people and culture and history and immigration and the beautiful ways that she expressed that. Like, there's room for all of it. Certainly because I was a national critic for 5 years, I will be writing about the country, about the state, but right now, with so much happening at the Los Angeles Times, the number of people on staff, like, just blowing up with new cooking.
Real investment from your
A real order. Investment, That's Dr. Really- Patrick Soon-Shiong, real investment. So, you know, the most important thing is for us to just get Los Angeles under our belts. And I think after that, there'll be a lot more fluidity and flexibility about what we want to be doing.
Absolutely. And I hope I didn't come off and say that it isn't a full-time job to review restaurant a week. Because that is, the deadline comes like every couple of days.
Yeah, I was listening to Pete Wells talk about that on your recent podcast, and I was just like, amen, brother. Like, you know, if editors or people think that one deadline a week is just breezy, they are mistaken.
Because
so much goes into picking the restaurants, scouting out the restaurants, going to restaurants multiple times, going to places that you're not going to, making sure that there's a mix of restaurants that you want geographically, by cuisine, by price tier, by, you know, just all sorts of considerations.
Let's talk about the yeoman's work. Let's talk about digging into the actual picks. And how do you actually pick your restaurants to review? Are you working with the new food editor, Peter Meehan? Are you having an open dialogue? Or are you kind of dictating it and telling Pete, here's where I'm going?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's almost something in the middle. It turns out that Patricia and I are both very earnest, polite people in person. And so there's a lot of, you know, no, by all means, you take that. No, you take that. And so I think that we're just very egalitarian in how we're divvying things up. And so far, there's been absolutely no stepping on toes. And Peter Meehan was the 25 and under columnist writing restaurant criticism for the New York Times for many years. So Peter understands this beat innately, and so he's not telling us where to go. We pick our stuff.
It's really a unique setup, I must say, having two critics who are kind of covering the same beat versus a 25 and under and the full restaurant critic. Does that feel refreshing to you to have this?
100% refreshing. And honestly, I think for publications that have the means to employ restaurant critics, this is the path forward, because the moment of kind of dividing cuisines psychologically by what's affordable and cheap, or what kind of gets relegated to, you know, a specific special interest column almost, and what the main critic, you know, may or may not assign stars to, but gets the big treatment. Nope. It particularly doesn't fit in a city like Los Angeles.
Absolutely not. It's almost like quality at scale. Like, you want two quality reviews, which is double the amount for the New York Times. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And it's fun. I mean, this is the first time I've been in this situation in the 17 years that I've been reviewing restaurants, but it's so nice to have a sense of solidarity with another person in every way. Like, are you struggling this week with writing? Yes, me too. God, are you like eating up to the last minute? Yes, me too. It's so, you know, and it's fun because we're so different.
Yeah.
We're just different as writers and people. And it's just, you know, it does feel really refreshing to just have somebody right alongside me with such her very own specific perspective.
And it's shown in the reviews. You've had three or four at this time of this recording, and it really seems like you're carving out what your style and your writing style. I wanted to ask you about Los Angeles and kind of brushing up on what's happening here. You've, as a roving critic for Eater, you came here often and you wrote extensively about California, but still you weren't living in Los Angeles. So tell me, what were some of the, were there any like canonical texts that you consulted? Did you do a lot of meetings? Did you talk to people? How did you kind of get ready to be their critic here?
It's a good question. I had about a month on the ground to be eating before reviews, the review machine started up and never stops. And so, of course, you know, I know a lot of the food writers in town. So, of course, I talked to people, I read, I kind of backtracked. Obviously, you know, I'm like everyone else who cares about restaurant criticism in America. I read Jonathan regularly, so I knew where he'd been and I knew what I needed to catch up on from where he'd been. And also, you know, what had just opened since he passed away in July. And so there was kind of a gap of what had been covered, and it was important to kind of assess what needed to be filled in and what not. Did not need to be filled in and just kind of left there. And I just took it from there. The bottom line is always, it's about eating, just eating, eating.
And really just making those assessments day after day. I want to talk about your first couple of reviews. I've been here for almost 5 days, so I've been able to go to Fiona. I've also been to Tacos 1986.
Oh, great.
I've been to both. But why did you pick Fiona? I'm interested. I agree with you. I had a really excellent meal there.
Did you go for lunch?
I went there for dinner.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. I haven't been back for dinner since I reviewed the restaurant. I'm glad you had a good experience.
Yeah, I had a good experience. Tell me about why did you pick that one?
Well, the restaurant is... First and foremost, it is owned by Nicole Rucker, who is one of the great pastry chef stars of Los Angeles. She is particularly known for pie, which is one of my, like, I have kind of this handful of obsessions, a lot of which I wrote about for Eater because I was just able to, had the privilege of indulging them wandering around the country for so long. Also, it's an interesting collaboration with Sean Fan, who is a chef who's had his own restaurant here and brings his own very specific background to the menu. There's a beef stew that incorporates his Vietnamese American heritage and a cool toast that he's channeling, dahi toast, or dahi toast, depending on the dialect. I'm still getting that right. I've been schooled. That has curry leaves and yogurt on it. Anyway, I just loved the narrative this story told about Los Angeles. And I guess I should say, as somebody who's coming off the national beat, to be again a city critic as I was in Atlanta and Dallas and in San Francisco, what I found fascinating was the day that review came out, the response was like, fuck yeah, like Los Angeles, like gets this. The Angelenos are like, good pick, we understand, great. And then the next day, the national media was like, Bill Addison reviews pie for his first restaurant
review.
And I was like, this isn't just a bakery. And if you read the and I was like,
haters.
yeah,
they didn't pay for they, what it is, they didn't pay for the review, they didn't actually pay the paywall.
You get three articles, don't you? I don't know. So anyway, I just thought that was and that wasn't everyone. I'm generalizing, but that was sort of the reaction that I noticed on social media, and it made me laugh because I was like, would I have done that? Would I have reduced somebody's work to, like, you know, two words? So anyway, but Los Angeles gets it, and that's
what's important. You're serving your readers, your online readers. You're serving the Orange County, the paper that hits the doorstep of Orange County.
we will be reviewing more in Orange County. Absolutely,
I see. It's interesting. I've been thinking about who you write for, because LA is such it's a bunch of suburbs. I mean, that's just kind of how I envision it as a New Yorker. But
that is how you'd envision it as a New Yorker. I lived in Sunbelt cities most of my adult life. life, Atlanta and Dallas. And so I'm like, I love sprawling cities. No. This is home to me. So I'm never leaving here, I don't think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is like my forever home. I'm feeling it.
Let's talk about Tacos 1986. Okay. It was raining and I was lucky because I only waited for like 5 minutes. But then I looked on Instagram and it was like a line. Aziz Ansari shows up at the couple hours after me.
Oh, wow.
Like, yeah.
Okay. Oh, I missed that. Interesting.
So he can appear in taco stands now. It's like okay to Instagram Aziz, I guess. But tell me why I picked that place. It's a really unique setup. It's in Koreatown. It's not in a traditional Mexican neighborhood. But why pick that place?
I think it was such a fascinating glimpse for me into how the food mechanisms work in Los Angeles right now.
Sure.
Like, it got a lot of attention on social media, and so I was like, all right, I'm gonna check this out, you know, how is it? And then I thought, well, not only are these tacos like really righteously good, but this guy Jorge Alvarez Tostada, who goes by Joy or El Joy, like, is just a character. He's a preening character, and in a way that, having, you know, eaten at a lot of taco joints over the years in Los Angeles, I had never encountered anyone quite like him. And so it just seemed right to kind of, you know, frame a portrait of this place at this moment.
And it's part, and that's like really the gold tradition, which is like picking a taco a cart or stand or restaurant every 5 reviews. It feels like that's just the beat, that's the rhythm, the metabolism of the LA Times critic.
Yep. And I'm happy to embrace that. I believe in it.
It's so cool to see you following the tradition and being it's smart. I mean, I respect it. So that's at 6 and Western, right?
Yes.
So
exactly.
In a mall. I love it. So you got to go there, listener. 6 and Western.
Or at Smorgasburg on Sunday mornings in Row DTLA.
Let's like talk about how great Smorgasburg is.
Yeah.
I personally, I do not go to the one in New York. I don't think I've been there in like literally 10 years. But what Zach Brooks has done with Smorgasburg Los Angeles, I go there every single time I come to LA. Talk about
it. Always something new. Yeah, always something that I'm looking at. It's so nice to see Pancho's Clayudas there as well. There's some barbecue that's happening there that I'm excited about. So yeah, it's really a very smartly gathered group.
Yeah, Fritos Las Palmas.
Chefs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I love it. So tell me, I want to know about like your mission right now, continuing the weekly reviews, but you said you want to go to Orange County a little bit more. How far out are you going to go? Out in, like, what is Los Angeles?
Right. I think
is Palm Springs Los Angeles? Because we could talk about Palm Springs food.
Sure, which I actually don't know that much about. I have spent exactly one night in Palm Springs in my entire life. And that was on the Eater beat last year when we were doing a guide to California. So I would say, honestly, that everything is fair game in California. You know, the company that now owns the Los Angeles Times is called the California Times. And so, again, you know, it's for me, first of all, it's funny because I traveled because I, you know, and I started the Eater job in March 2014. I was traveling like 5 days a week, 3 weeks out of the month. And by the time it ended, and this was on understanding, like, this is just what, like, this job happened to me. My editors didn't tell me to do it. I didn't do it intentionally. I just, like, got lost on the road.
Yeah.
And so I was gone almost full time. And it feels so good not to travel right now. Like, good in a way that I could not have expected. So I'm flipping through Instagram and, you know, we all do our performative travel posts there. And I'm like, no FOMO, no FOMO. Don't care. Don't care. Go. Good for you. Have fun. Great. And then I'll get back there at some point. But my body is just so happy to be, you know, not only in one place and on the precipice of having my own home again, but also to be in a city that completely satisfies whatever juice is left in the well of my wanderlust.
And there's extensive wanderlust in your future, but you're here for the near future.
Yeah,
I think.
And there's so much. I mean, and it's just like so satisfying to be, you know, just Google any cuisine and be like, okay, so there is one restaurant here.
Let's talk about that. I wanted to ask you, in terms of a cuisine or two in LA that you really maybe have been surprised that there's a community there, or just maybe on just like your tick list where you want to go and dive into. We know Korea, Mexico, we have these like tent poles.
Yeah.
It's, and you could write about that all day. But
the regional cuisines of China that have been here for so long. Yeah. I am really, really interested in the foods of the Middle East. And so I am slowly kind of finding my way around those in this city. They exist here. I see a lot of repetition. And so I'm a little,
I feel a lot of repetition because you go to these restaurants, and that's a, like you just said something that a lot of people don't realize, like you feel the repetition and you feel uninspired and you have to skip these restaurants.
Yeah. Because I'm wondering, like, you know, it's sort of the same thing, I guess, honestly, as a corollary to what Pete was talking about a few weeks ago about the Korean restaurant he did where, you know, you dig in and you're like, okay, well, this one does a good stew. This one does good barbecue. This one does good banchan. You know, I'm like, okay, this one may do good, you know, fried kibbeh, and this one will do good Jordanian mansaf, maybe, and this one, you know, will do some, I don't know. I want to find like more homey Syrian dishes, but I don't, and Iranian Persian dishes, but I'm having a hard time finding those in restaurants, so we'll see.
Do you drive or do you take Uber?
Oh, I drive.
You drive?
Most every time. I mean, if I'm going to a tasting, I like to drink, but I don't drink that much on reviews or in general right now because I'm in Los Angeles, Southern California. I'm trying to like stay fit.
What about speaking of like alcohol and like avoiding it and maybe moderate? Do you indulge in CBD and marijuana? Do you find that part of your?
Yeah, I mean, it could be part of the beat here.
Yeah.
I have not partaken of that professionally yet, but I would be open to it if there was a smart reason to. Yeah, I'm sure that we're going to see more of that, but at the moment, it's all just in sort of pop-up forms, and honestly, I don't know the legal stuff around that right off the top of my head, so I don't know what's
there's other things to cover at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But I'm sure it's a moving target, and I mean, the LA Times has covered it extensively in its great reporting. Right. I had breakfast with Danielle Galarza, your former colleague at Eater, and she had this great question, and I got to give her credit for it. It's great. So, Bill, you're a white guy. How do you stay woke?
Well, first of all, I mean, that's a funny question in that I think the word woke, like, should be buried, first of all.
Maybe that's why she asked.
Right. Yeah. I think that's it. First of all, Sam Sanders of NPR wrote a great piece about why we should retire the word woke, and I am on that tip. So if you're asking how I stay, you know, culturally sensitive, I feel like the world is doing it for me, you know. And that's just, you know, I understand the privilege of this position, and I'm just gonna live up to the responsibility.
Yeah,
and
I think
as best as I can.
Good answer. I think I'm not gonna push you on that because I think it is the world is around us and it is taken care of as well as it can in early 2019.
Yeah.
But we also have a ways to go
in
food
media,
specifically.
Yep.
Because we both work in that.
So. Yes, we do.
Let's talk about just in general. Have you had a favorite meal since you've actually been here a couple months ago? I want to just get that one.
Yeah, I have. I actually am not going to tell you what it is, but I'm going to tell you that you can read about it on April 11th when the new freestanding food section debuts in the Los Angeles Times.
That's incredible. What is that exactly? And how has the food section run up until the April 11th date?
It got folded into a lifestyle section just called Saturday in the Saturday paper. But, you know, I'm excited because this, you know, harkens back to some real glory days when Ruth Reichel and Lori Ochoa were the editors of the freestanding food section. And it's exciting, you know, to see it coming back. It's deserved. It's Los Angeles. Like, it's the center of the culinary conversation in America now. So cooking in, dining out, like, we're going to cover it all.
It's Thursdays, is that right?
Yes.
Oh, that's going to
be on Thursday.
So Wednesday's New York Times, Thursday's LA Times.
Yep, exactly.
Do you feel there's like a little bit of a rivalry just already started? I mean, Peter being here, used to work at the New York Times. I mean, friendly rivalry, I'm sure, is mutual respect.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like we're all living up to the, we're all striving to live up to the moment that presents itself to us. You know what I mean? Like, this is a great moment, and we should be reflecting how exciting and multicultural and energized and alive this city is right now.
The city, and also, let's just talk about your readers and their interest and thirst for knowledge about food, about dining in and or cooking in and dining out.
Well, they're very smart, and I love that. And I like getting, it's been fun to start. I haven't been at a newspaper in 12 years since I was at the Dallas Morning News. So it's fun to re-engage that newspaper audience. They like to write, and they, you know, and I didn't get too much email at Eater other than when I had a newsletter and would ask for specific recommendations and people would send them. But I like hearing people's opinions about what I'm covering and what I shouldn't be covering
and how I should cover.
You know, there is a lot, honestly, I'm sorry to repeat something, but there is a lot of interest in people, more than I would imagine, in covering the OC and covering Orange County. So, and there is a lot down there. It is a trek. Part of me is like, can I just go down like for the weekend and spend it there? But I guess that's because I live on the east side of Los Angeles. But again, that's part of the gig. So I'm going to be getting down there. I know Patricia has her eye on some stuff. But, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that's important is acknowledging the wealth of culinary cultures here in the at-home recipes, you know, kind of as beautiful and iconic a job as Jonathan did sort of showing Los Angeles who it was through its restaurants. I think that there's a way to also show Los Angeles who it is through recipes that they can make at home.
And Genevieve Coe is running that program.
And
it sounds
Ben
like.
Mims. Yeah.
And Ben Mims.
Yeah. And so between the two of them, they're going to get that job done.
That's great. I like to hear that a lot. I think we've covered LA home cooks a bit in taste with several articles in the past 2.5 years. And I agree, you can learn a lot from cooking with people at home, with citizens of Los Angeles. So to see that balance on the Thursday section will be really, really nice to see.
Yeah.
But let's talk about your own cooking, because I know you obviously have very limited time to cook at home, but you come from a background of a professional cooking. So like, you're going to cook obviously a little bit at home. What are you going to make in your new kitchen, Bill? Once you unpack the pots and pans.
Yeah, I'm gonna be a regular at the Hollywood Sunday Farmers Market.
So great.
Yeah, so great. I mean, that is just like, wow.
And Santa Monica too. Wow.
Sure. And that one is on Wednesdays.
Yeah.
Is that right?
And
yeah.
Saturdays. Too,
right.
Yeah.
So because that's the West Side, I'm gonna have to like plan a little more. Yeah. That is the reality of it. Is Los Angeles, and it is true. Like I got here and I was like, of course I'll drive all over the place. And now I'm, you know, for my own purposes, no, I'll go, you know, I'll drive this far, 20 minutes or so. But otherwise, you know, I'm just driving for when I eat all over the place. But yeah, I'm most excited, you know, I used to be a pastry chef. And so it's like the fruit that I'm excited about, the like 8 varieties of apricots that'll be available, and the berries and the peaches and the pluots and the I'm just excited.
Galettes, like, what are you gonna make? Tarts?
Yeah, I know this is like this, it sounds prosaic, but I really love fruit crisp, and Nancy Silverton had the best recipe for fruit crisp, where I mean I make kind of a very like nut forward, but let's say okay, I'm making a peach crisp. Yeah. This is a Nancy Silverton trick, but I will make brown butter that a vanilla bean is simmering in, and then I will take that and pour that over the fruit, and then put the topping on, and then maybe like a pistachio kind of topping with like peaches, and it's so good.
Because peaches are, hey, they're around for more than like 22 days.
Yeah, exactly. And they're right, because I lived in Georgia for many years, and the good peaches, you know, often came from there, South Carolina, and they were gone in a blink.
Gone in a blink, and same with New York. I mean, we get them from there. Are you going to host some dinner parties? Probably.
I probably will. Yeah. Although I think that I'll more be like the popular guest who brings a nice dessert to dinner parties.
Like it.
That's what I'm hoping for.
So we've had a couple critics on the podcast. We've had Pete Wells. We've had Robert Saitsima. And so for you, I want to ask, we always have an illustration. We ask all the critics this. We can't obviously show your face. How should we illustrate you?
You put this question to me and I did not come up with a satisfying answer. What, you know what? Oh, I'm a Maryland guy. I love crab. Illustrate me with a crab, a blue crab, a Maryland blue crab.
I love that, Bill.
I'm a little crabby sometimes, so that's fine.
I was going to go there.
It's okay. Go there.
Critics are thinking crabby. Bill Addison, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Tyler and Kim Malik, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. This is exciting.
Well, I just must say, I'm a huge fan of what you do. I've been to your locations in Portland and in LA. Mm-hmm. And I love Larchmont Village location. Aww. Like, is that was your first location outside of Portland, right?
Yeah, it was. It was funny because we were doing a little kind of collaboration with Jones on Third, and someone suggested we go around the city and kind of get to know some different neighborhoods because we were getting a lot of requests to open a store there. And I remember we turned down Larchmont Avenue and it was like beautiful tree-lined streets and people out shopping, and it felt like our people. So we one thing led to the next.
And a wonderful bookstore right next door.
Yes, it is. Magazines out on the, you know, street, just kind of like old school. It's old school. I love it.
I want to ask, you own now, I think there's 20 some odd locations in five cities and growing. It's probably more. What goes through your head every morning when you wake up?
For me, I think I get to be with the ice cream every day. And so I focus on, I think, just channeling the creativity as much as possible and making sure that my team is kind of just constantly working on the right projects. So I get to work with my R&D team, you know, spend the first 2 hours of each day with them, talk to them about what flavors we're working on, taste through everything. And the beauty is that we're to the size where we can actually test flavors, you know, 100 different times before we actually put them out and publish the recipe. And there's just like this creative process that's so, it's become methodical in a really beautiful way. And I think that's what has really, it's inspiring in this really interesting way that you would never expect.
But there's like some jazz to it too, right? Like, you say methodical, but it's like art, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've set up the foundation for us to really, you know, especially when we're working with partners or working with other food industry folks, you know, it's we get to bounce ideas off of them and just jam, and we get to, you know, pass ice cream back and forth, test, get their feedback, play around with different flavors.
That's awesome. What about you? What do you think about?
You know, we were just in LA last week, and someone from the entertainment industry said a quote that I've been thinking about a lot lately, and that's, you know, how do we make sure that we're worthy of our audience? Mm-hmm. And I love that quote, and I think that is what I think about every morning when I wake up. And I think about, you know, we've been really fortunate to have a great following in the cities that we're in and become sort of a community gathering place in those cities. And we have an amazing, we have a tribe of 500 employees now. And I want to be worthy of their life's energy that they show up and dedicate to this cause on a daily basis. And then all these artisans that Tyler's talking about, you know, how do we make sure we carry that torch forward in a way that's true to them? So I feel it's just such a great honor, and I feel really lucky and fortunate.
They're great employees, and I can't say that about all food retail. I think that you've got, especially I remember the Venice location. This guy was just so memorable to me. I just still think about it. Like, he was just so kind and cool.
Aww.
Not just with samples, because that's like obviously any ice cream place gives samples, but just like thinking about this, like, service. He had really good service.
It's so fun. I mean, I love serving ice cream, and I think that's, there's just this enjoyment. I think our team, you know, as long as we're taking care of them and we're providing this kind of fun, safe place for them to work. There's this dynamic between our servers and our guests that just it's explosive, and it creates this journey, like you were saying, tasting through all the flavors, but more than that, like creating this really deep connection with your...
We just got a note. So we just opened not too long ago in downtown Disneyland, which I can't believe those words come out of my mouth. It's kind of amazing.
In Anaheim,
oh, California. Man. And we got a note just a couple days ago from a customer who wrote in to say that she drove for several hours to get to Disneyland with her kids, and the park was shut down for a private event. And so she brought her kids, who had tears in their eyes, into our shop in Salt and Straw, and the person that helped them, she went on and on about what an incredible experience he turned it into for the kids. And she said they left skipping and smiling and asking when they could come back. And I had tears in my eyes reading that story. But yeah, those kind of connections are what, you know, what makes me think we could be on the right track. And I feel really, I love the people we work with. Yeah. It's incredible.
And Kim, you have a really cool background. You worked at Starbucks first as a barista, but then later in corporate when Starbucks had like 30 cafes.
It was tiny.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. How did that inform what you have done with Salt and Straw as a business? And we talked a lot about hospitality in that term as well.
Yeah, I started when there were 30 stores. And I remember when I graduated from college, I got a job in the quote unquote corporate office. It was a tiny little one floor building at the time. And my parents felt sad for me because I didn't get a very good job out of college. I kept saying, no, this is going to be big someday. And this guy, Howard Schultz, really is onto something. And I think one moment I remember working there that really informed how I approached Salt and Straw was we had a store meeting, and I remember Howard Schultz showed up to that meeting, and I was a barista, and he just was telling us with every cell of his being, you know, how important the work we were doing and, you know, where the coffee came from and what role we wanted to play in the world. And I could tell, like, this was up to us to bring this to life. And I wanted to carry that on to the people I work with and make everybody feel like they're part of something bigger. You know, he was the first company to offer health insurance to part-time employees and offer, you know, stock options to baristas, and just really generous from that perspective. And so we also, when we wrote our business plan to start the company, set it up that way so that the team could be part of the success and really have it be a people-centered business.
Let's talk about the origins. You write in your new cookbook about the moment you decided to open your own retail operation. You went to a Goodwill. You spent $16 on 4 ice cream makers. Tell this story. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, well, I love this story of when we first started. I think the dream was to figure out how do you make ice cream in the first place. And for me, I'm a culinary school dropout, so I've played with a few different ingredients. But at the end of the day, there's ice cream. It's so accessible. It's surprisingly easy. You take cream, sugar, and freeze it together. And if it freezes, then it's ice cream. If it doesn't, then it's sweet soup, which is still delicious.
Doesn't sell as well, though.
No.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's the science behind it is interesting, but at the end of the day, making ice cream, it should be freeing. And so, yeah, it's one of those things that I think it scared so many people away, ice cream making in general, that now you can go and you see these ice cream makers at Goodwill everywhere. And they're
also very cheap to buy on Amazon, too. They're like $21.
Yeah. Yeah. And you pre-freeze it. Yeah. You can make one batch a day, and that's sometimes all you need. And that was fun for us. So when we first started, we got to make 4 flavors a day. Because then you have to let it freeze overnight again. And
in the kitchen.
Just redid it over and over again. Just tested, you know, 100 different flavors as we were kind of coming up with what a dream menu might be. And that was it. It was trial and error, and it was just like getting to it, which I loved.
Tyler was amazing, though, because I remember before he showed up with his ice cream makers to start making ice cream in our kitchen, he was testing recipes at home north of Seattle and sending me all these ideas that he was coming up with. And I kept saying, you know, first of all, I'm not going to bring my family into this crazy idea because what if it crashes and burns? And secondly, you don't know how to make ice cream, and I really need someone who does. And so after receiving, I mean, I don't know, probably 50 different recipes that he was testing. He said, I'll just come and help run errands. I just want to help start the company. And he showed up. And of course, we quickly realized he's really good at making ice cream.
Clearly. I mean, but has this family connection helped? I mean, it helped like solidify this business? I mean, as if you were friends, would it be the same?
I mean, it's kind of funny to me. I think it comes down to a lot just values. I mean, I don't mean to sound too grandiose here, but I can't tell you the number of times when Tyler shows up in the morning and he says, you know, I've been reading this and this article about something we can do, and I've been reading the same article that night. And so we're very like-minded from that perspective. But at the same time, you know, he works on coming up with ice cream flavors and I work on negotiating deals with landlords. Yeah. I always say I pull the short end of the stick. But what I mean by that is that we have such very different focuses within the company that mm-hmm. it works really well. And Tyler probably has the least ego I've ever met, which I think contributes to his ability to collaborate and be really creative in an unusual way, but also just a really good business partner. So if you're looking for a business partner, look for that, I'd
yeah.
say.
And clearly defined roles, I think, is definitely something that you want to have in a business
yeah.
partnership too. JJ Good and I, your collaborator, mm-hmm. well-known food writer and
contributor
to Taste, a hero to many. We were emailing last night. I was like, I got the guys, the team coming in, and he's like, I'm like, what should I ask? And he said, ask Tyler to make an ice cream flavor on the spot.
Oh, yeah.
So what is that?
This is a fun game.
Play this game. Let's do it.
Well, this is so that we invented this game when I first started going to elementary schools, which we go every year. And spend hours and hours with each of the elementary schools near our shops. And then they invent flavors that then we feature in our shop. And then the proceeds go back to their school. So it's this like really cool, like cyclical. Yeah, it's the most amazing menu of the year. So we started this game where we actually say, like, let's crowdsource some ideas. So we kind of had to do that, which I don't know. Do you want to try? Should we try it?
Let's try it.
Do you have an ingredient?
Me? You should come up with
okay.
one. I'm too close to it.
Why not? What do you want me? What do you need
yeah.
from me?
How about just three. Let's start with one. One ingredient that just like
pops
you love.
This
just
really just
ingredient.
Popped in my head. I didn't prep this.
Okay.
Kombucha.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Okay. Do you have a second? Do you want?
Yeah, one? Definitely. Peanut butter.
Kombucha and peanut butter.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. One more?
You need a third?
Yeah,
yeah. Let's do tropical fruit. So let's do pineapple.
Okay. Mm. Cool. I like this. So you know what I love? Like, have you had kombucha with some of the warming spices? Like, I think we could do that. And if we like baked that into the pineapple and made almost this like pineapple, like, jelly or jam, and then like we could get some really cool tropical spices in the peanut butter and make a base out of that base ice cream, like I don't know, something that like Thai basil almost or something like that, or like kefir lime in the base, and like get that like spicy profile to marry with the like that tart acidic kind of funky pineapple.
I'm buying this.
Let's do that.
Isn't that
I
fun?
Love it. Yeah. Tropical fruits and peanut butter is the worst combination, but
no, it's I think JJ had some harder ones. I think I can't remember when we played this game.
It's so fun. I love that game, and it's so cool that you can do that with kids, because it really gets kids into making ice cream. Let's segue to the book a little bit.
Okay, perfect.
Because I think making ice cream is what you want folks to do with this cookbook. I must say, I'm very objective about this opinion, even though we're here at Penguin Random House and are making your book. I think there's a lot of ice cream books out there. I mean, it's no secret. So how is this book going to separate itself from all the other books out there?
We wanted to go in a very, very different direction when we started writing this book. I think my dream was to I think the story that you told about the Goodwill was a perfect example. There's a lot of people that will get a book and get an ice cream maker, and they think, you know, I'm going to make all these recipes. And there's something terrifying with how most ice cream recipes are written. In reality, it shouldn't be that way. Really, like I said, like cream, sugar, melt it together, put it in a freezer, and that's ice cream. And that's so just like freeing to think that there's not much rule, that shouldn't be many rules around this. And so we really tried to like we tried to play with that accessibility in how we wrote the recipes, how we really like put forth how we think about a foundation of ice cream, and then start integrating some of the science so that it can you can really start like learning about the ingredients around you and start really getting inspired by how to use that.
On the note of science, you write about the secret superhero of ice cream is.
Yeah, so we use a few different ingredients, I think, and our trick is in the base recipe, we actually create a foundation, almost like a, I think of it like a soup stock, right? Like you can make chicken stock, you can make ice cream base. And so with that, like that soup stock or this ice cream base, you can make 100 different flavors. We use one ingredient in particular that I really, really love in this. It's kind of scary because it starts with an X. It's called xanthan gum, but it's a form of cornstarch, basically. And it's really easy to cook with. It's easy to like mix into your ice cream. And it what it does is it allows like it gives us some forgiveness in our recipe. So we can be a lot more creative and you can make a lot more mistakes when you're making your ice cream.
And Kim, I wanted to ask you about ice creams as a kid. I know it's like there's so many memories we have about ice cream as children. And I think you're informed by them clearly with this business because you're very kid friendly, obviously. What were some of the ice cream brands that you really remember and recall as a child?
You know, it's so funny that you should bring up the letter X and talk about children, because I, my partner and I adopted three children a couple of years ago, and my five-year-old was just studying the letter X, and it does get a bad rap. And it leads me to think about how just the experience of going out for ice cream with my family, now having children, has totally changed how I think about even owning this company, because it creates those memories that are like none other. I mean, I was standing in our Venice shop the other day, and I was blown away by how many teenagers were standing in line with their parents. I'm like, where do you see teenagers doing something with their parents? And for me, back in Billings, Montana, that was Baskin and Robbins. I mean, we would get to go out for ice cream, and, you know, it made the challenging times better and the good times, you know, a celebration. So I can still remember those moments.
Baskin Robbins was your one. How about
Billings,
you?
Billings, Montana.
Yeah. How about you? What was yours?
Well, mine was also Baskin Robbins. But we got to, I remember when I was in fourth grade. And it took me a while to remember, like, have this memory. Like, I think there's 3 years after we started the company. When I was in fourth grade, we got to tour and we got to go into the back freezer of the Baskin Robbins. And I twirled around and I was like, the guy, this like franchise owner, was like, I get to eat all the ice cream I want. And I was like, shut up. And so that was my dream for that full year of being a fourth grader, to own an ice cream shop one day.
Be careful what you wish for.
I know. Do you have any connection to like ice cream royalty? I think of like Ben and Jerry's, or any of the major figures in American ice cream history and culture?
You know, our grandmother is probably our biggest connection to, I mean, we use so many of her recipes in our recipes, and always have a connection to her through a lot of what's brought us together in the early times as we were coming up with our flavors. But no, we're just blazing our own trail. You know, we're West Coasters, so we don't have those connections like you.
Okay, so let's get to the West Coast, East Coast thing. I mean, it's more just selfish for me. You clearly have a real focus on the West Coast for your shops and your locations. Are you selling pints, though, around the country? That's happening?
Yeah, so you can order pints online. It was funny. We had a reporter from the Wall Street Journal while we were still a cart who said she wanted to do a review of our ice cream, but we had to sell nationally in order for her to do the review. And Tyler and I were like, what does that even mean? And she said, well, you know, maybe mail order, you could ship it. And we've been doing that ever since. But she said, you have 3 weeks to come up with this business. And so that was the launch to our mail order business. And
that's
we've done
so
it ever
fascinating.
Since.
I love the honesty. And that's, sometimes reporters will bring a great idea to the
we stumbled into it and we've been doing it ever since. And despite our best efforts, it has quite a following, and people, I think it's amazing you can ship ice cream in the mail. It doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
So we do that. And you can buy pints in New York at the Meadow. So Mark Bitterman owns the Meadow, and we use his salt in our sea salt caramel ice cream. So there's a connection there. And then at Daily Provisions, you can get ice cream, which is Danny Meyer's shop.
So. Yeah, and Danny is an investor in your company.
Yes,
too.
We love Danny.
Yeah. Okay, so but what about opening a shop in New York?
What about that? I mean, it's so cold
you're here. You're in New York right now, and it's probably not just to do a podcast interview. Are you looking at locations?
I just said I have three little kids in Portland. So for us, we're still a pretty small company. We've been around for 7 years now. And this experience that we offer in our shops is so important to us. And taking a huge leap across the country would mean, making sure we could hold that up and bring our best game forward. So the other thing that's weird about us is every city we go to, weird in a wonderful way, mm-hmm. is every city we go to has its own menu. And so that's sort of a limiting factor in terms of how fast we can grow.
Absolutely love that concept. I feel Shake Shack is similar.
Yeah, they do some of that too.
They have that model, and I think it's actually really important when you're scaling to have some kind of connection to the community. And I appreciate that. So you're in five cities now. So each of these five cities, it's just one example of a unique menu item in one of these cities.
Yeah, they basically have completely different menus in each city. And it's really cool because it creates this, when you visit a shop in Seattle versus Portland versus San Francisco, it's going to be a completely different experience. So in Seattle, we get to work with Beecher's Cheese, and we make a flavor with them that's just like, it's based off of their green peppercorn flagship cheese that's like insane. Whereas then in Portland, you'll get to learn about maybe the local strawberries and one of the really cool honey balsamic maker nearby. Whereas then in San Francisco, you get to learn about this, bean to bar chocolate maker, dandelion. So it's when you go into each of our shops, I think you get this, it's a journey through the city, and we almost get to use our ice cream like a pedestal to like preach those beautiful stories.
It's really a smart idea. Last question. I want to know, I'm opening the book. What is the first recipe I need to tackle?
Mm. We debated a lot on this. The first recipe you'll see in the book is going to be our olive oil ice cream. And it's one of those flavors that it honestly, I think it's an easier flavor than vanilla even, in the sense that it's olive oil with cream, sugar, you mix it all together and you put it in a machine. And it's beautiful. The science, you can either get really heavy in the science or you can use no science whatsoever and it'll still like work out.
And what's the texture of olive oil ice cream?
Oh, it's velvety. It's got this like the combination of multiple different fat profiles actually creates a it's this chewiness, this texture that almost it's like velvet, it's beautiful.
It's spring now, and it's like going into summer and we're thinking it's like ice cream season, but I like fucking reject that. Please tell me that there is no ice cream season. Explain to our audience that there is no ice cream season.
No, there's no ice cream season. I think, for us, we change our menu every 4 weeks and we really live and die by that code. And every month that you come into Salt and Straw, it's going to be a completely different menu based off of what we feel is important in the city around us. And so that means that, in February, we're fortunate enough to have lines, but it's because there's a brand new story about, all these different chocolatiers in the city. Or in November, you get to taste through Thanksgiving flavors all in one, one scoop of ice cream. So it's this tempo, this excitement in the menus that we bring forth, I think really kind of shatters that mold.
Tyler and Kim Malik, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Aww,
thank you.
So fun to be here. Thank you.
The Taste Podcast is hosted by Matt Rodbard and me, Anna Heasel. The show is produced by Gabrielle Lewis, studio recordings by Pat Stango, theme music by Steve Rydell. Interviews are recorded live at Books Are Magic in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, and at Penguin Random House Studios in Manhattan. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com. Thanks for listening.